This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, September 26, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, police crack down on New York protesters in the heart of the city's financial district. In Libya, families of the disappeared raise concerns over the handling of a mass grave. And as world leaders consider statehood for Palestinians, we'll speak to a Kashmiri leader about the decades-long conflict in his region and hopes for self-determination. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Bolivia's Minister of Defense resigned today after police violently broke up an indigenous protest camp. Sean Arquinego and Aldo Orellana report from Cochabamba.
Cecilia Chacon called the police action unjustifiable. Last night, hundreds of Bolivian police fired tear gas and used batons to break up a peaceful protest march headed for La Paz. A six-month-old baby died after inhaling tear gas. Dozens were injured, and more than 30 others are unaccounted for. The march was led by native Bolivians who are opposed to a highway construction project that would cut through their territory. Some 1,500 people were camped outside the town of Yucumo. Government officials claim that they entered the camp in an attempt to diffuse tensions between marchers and the residents of the town who support the highway construction project. Rolando Viena, head of the Bolivian Ombudsman Office, demanded a halt to violence and threatened to pursue legal action against the government. Vigils and protests are now being carried out in major cities around Bolivia against the actions of the government. Sean Arquinego, FSRN, Cochabamba.
The Mexican state of Veracruz has become a major hotspot in the so-called war against drugs. Until now, the major actors have been members of organized crime or federal forces. But Shannon Young explains that may be changing.
Several aspects of the violence in Veracruz make it stand out from the bloodshed in other parts of Mexico, notably the emergence of an armed group bearing the appearance of a paramilitary organization. A group calling itself Los Matazetas, the Zeta Killers, has uploaded a couple of video communiques to the internet, the most recent one dated Saturday, September 24th. The video shows five men in ski masks wearing all black and seated at a table laid out in conference-style formality.
Nuestro único interés como objetivo son el cártel de los Zetas.
The speaker expressed respect for the armed forces and said the goal of the Matazetas is to fight the Zetas cartel in a way the military cannot due to legal restrictions. It was the first communique from the group since at least 35 bodies were dumped near an overpass in Boca del Río, Veracruz last week. A state government official claimed the dead were criminals before medical examiners had established the identities of all of the murder victims. The mother of a 15-year-old boy found among the dead said the last time she saw her son, he was in state police custody. Three reporters covering this story for major national media outlets were briefly detained on Thursday while documenting the condition of the bodies in the morgue and forced by armed Veracruz State Police to delete photos. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
For the first time since the 2010 Gulf oil disaster, BP has applied for permits to start drilling again off the Louisiana coast. The company wants to drill four new wells almost 6,000 feet down. A BP spokesperson says the company has learned its lesson and now has enhanced performance standards. Cynthia Sartho is with the Gulf Restoration Network.
Our concern is whether they have in fact, implemented the safety standards they say, and if not, whether they are actually any more capable than they were before at responding to a situation in which something goes wrong.
Federal regulators have until late next month to rule on BP's request. Kenya's Professor Wangari Maathai, the Nobel Peace Laureate of 2004, died last night. She was 71. John Bwakali has more from Nairobi.
Wangari Maathai was the first woman to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Decades earlier, she was also the first woman to be awarded a doctorate in all of East and Central Africa. Maathai founded the Green Belt Movement in 1977. Through it, she mobilized women across Kenya to empower themselves and conserve the environment by planting trees. This movement has since planted more than 47 million trees. In the 1980s, she was the environmental conscience of Kenya, taking on the government in defending natural spaces and resources both in urban and rural areas. Her courageous activism often landed her in prison, but she refused to be silenced. In 2002, she won a parliamentary seat and became the nation's Assistant Minister of Environment. After winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004, she steered the United Nations Environment Programme's Billion Tree campaign, greatly enhancing environmental awareness all over the world. Wangari Maathai died from ovarian cancer. She is survived by 3 adult children. John Bokali, FSRN, Nairobi.
And on Friday, a California jury awarded $4.5 million to the family of a homeless man who died while in police custody. Jurors found that 2 Eureka police officers used excessive force against Martin Cotton, and 3 others failed to provide him with medical care. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. In Bahrain today, a court set up by the monarchy sentenced the head of the teachers' union to 10 years in prison for participation in anti-regime protests. His deputy received 3 years. The sentences follow returned protests, which began last week ahead of elections that took place Saturday. Security forces used stun grenades, rubber bullets, and tear gas to disperse hundreds of protesters, according to witnesses in the village of Sanabas. A video posted on YouTube shows security forces in riot gear stomping on an unarmed man as he lies on the ground. A woman tries to intervene and a policeman sprays her in the face with a canister as a crowd gathers. According to the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, security forces attacked protesters in the lead-up to the voting. Government forces also arrested 45 women and girls in one of Bahrain's main shopping malls days before the election, according to the AP. The majority Shia opposition, critical of the monarchy rule, boycotted Saturday's election, which were scheduled to elect replacements for more than a dozen lawmakers who resigned in protest of how the regime responded to the demonstrations. A second round of voting will take place October 1st, as some candidates failed to win 50% of the vote. In Libya, hundreds of civilians are fleeing the city Sirte after NATO bombing on Sunday, and more are facing shortages of food and medicine, according to the AP. The National Transitional Council said yesterday they've discovered a mass grave in Tripoli containing the bodies of 1,270 inmates killed by Gaddafi's security forces. Today, families of the victims flocked to the site hoping to get some answers. Instead, they found little physical evidence of the mass grave and no doctor or official to supervise the search. Marine Olivesi sent us this report.
A young boy digs through a patch of sand, coarse gravel, and sunburnt wild grass, bare-handed. He's trying to pull out what looks like a pair of dark blue trousers buried deep in the ground. Then a man brings a broken spade and starts shoveling. A few seconds later, he goes down on his knees and takes out of the dirt something hard and curvy, the size of a tennis ball. He hands it to another man who's wearing a military uniform. The two men seem convinced they've just found a bone.
What is it?
Spinal cord bone. This bone is not complete, understand? Maybe in cervical bone, the neck or upper part of back.
Joma is a former inmate at Abu Salim. He says these men have no expertise in how to excavate or identify bodies.
I told them to stop doing that. They are not specialists in these things.
None of the men gathered here are doctors or even NTC officials. They're just civilians who came to the site this morning after hearing the news Sunday. A mass grave with the remains of up to 1,270 bodies was found. They wanted to see it for themselves and found a wasteland instead. 2 dozen bones have been put on display at the center of the site, but the large size looks more like parts of an animal rather than a human. More troubling, no one seems to be in charge of the premises.
I don't think this should happen. Anyone can walk in and see and lift things. Could be evidence, anything, and could be ruined. Yes. This is very disappointed, actually. I mean, this is not normal. Like, it's bones and bodies everywhere, and everyone come here and see and go. And
we want security in this situation.
Yes.
Security to protect this place, because it's
important for us.
And important for the many people.
It's important, yes.
Yes. It's so important.
Esman Assef and Ramsa Massoud were only 1 year old in 1989 when their fathers were both arrested and jailed in the same cell. The two friends said their fathers were thrown in jail only because they prayed at the mosque. They were not political activists, but the Qaddafi regime tagged them as Islamists. The two men were killed during the prison massacre. Joma, the former Abu Salim detainee, explains that inmates protested on June 28, 1996. They wanted torture to end in the jail and better detention conditions. Joma said that the following day, security forces asked hundreds of inmates to gather in the courtyard. Then they opened fire.
They took the whole people and put them in the yard, outside the yard, and then starting shooting them.
Human rights groups say that up to 2,000 inmates were killed on June 29, 1996. Inside Abu Salim, Joma said the authorities tried to placate the inmates who had stayed locked up during the rampage.
They said that there is nothing happened and they give us good food. Like, you know, if you are in a hotel for 15 days or 13 days, yes, honestly. Like, you know, five-star hotel, everything. If you, anything you need it, they will bring it to you. They don't want us to hear what's happened, and they want to cool us down.
To calm you down?
Yes, that's right. And after, they return back to the same story. No food, nothing, not like that. Torching and hitting and, you know, anything. They will do with you anything.
Families of inmates were still pleading for answers this past February. The lawyer had just been arrested and they demonstrated in Benghazi to demand his release. Many Libyans say the protest ultimately triggered the uprising that led to the ousting of Muammar Gaddafi. 7 months later, families of the victims hope they will finally be able to seek justice in court. The discovery of a mass grave would take them a step closer, but some warn this might not be it. The NTC admitted Sunday that they need the help of international experts and that it will take weeks or months to proceed to the identification of remains. Ramsa and Esma say they have no choice but to wait some more. Marine Olivesi, FSRN, Tripoli, Libya.
As eyes are on the UN Security Council as it plans to take up the application for Palestinian statehood, another long unresolved dispute is the subject of talks at the UN, Kashmir. The issue is being discussed between India and Pakistan as both countries have the Kashmir region under their administration. The main demand of the people in Indian-administered Kashmir is self-determination, which means independence from India. At the UN, the Organization of Islamic Conference, or OIC, held a special meeting on Kashmir on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly session. The meeting was attended by Kashmiri leader Mirwaz Omar Farooq of the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, or APHC. He spoke to FSRN's Salim Rizvi at the UN in New York.
Mr. Farooq, what is the basic demand now? It's been more than 60 years that this issue has been festering.
Well, first of all, I must say that the fact is that Kashmir remains the oldest unresolved issue on the agenda of the United Nations. And I think it is the duty of this august body to fulfill its commitments which they have made to the people of Kashmir. Today we are talking about Arab Spring, right from Libya to Tunisia, to Bahrain and other parts of the Arabian Peninsula. But the fact is that the people of Kashmir have been fighting for their rights for the last 65 years. And the world community has completely ignored the voices coming out of Kashmir. So we are encouraged to see that today that the OIC has reiterated its support to the Kashmir cause. They have shown their concern vis-à-vis the human rights violations in Kashmir. They have spoken in detail about especially the issue of the unidentified mass graves which have been found in Kashmir. I mean, you have to understand that recently 2,700 mass graves have been unearthed in Kashmir. More than 9,000 people are missing in Kashmir since 1990. So there is panic among those relations who have been looking for their kits and kins for the last so many years. And I think it's the duty of the world community and the OIC as well as the UN to come to Kashmir to at least help us to identify these graves. There should be DNA tests should be done, and it should be known that who are these people who have been killed and buried in these unidentified graves. So we hope that the OIC will continue to support the Kashmir cause, but I feel that the world community and especially the UN has to shun its double standard policy. They have, when they talk about other issues concerning the world peace, they can't ignore the voices coming out of Kashmir.
So do you feel that this issue, particularly for Kashmiris, this has been really vexed or has been sandwiched in between the two countries, say, yes, India and Pakistan?
Well, you know, definitely, you know, one can't differ with the fact that when you talk about Kashmir at the international level, it's either the Indian position or the Pakistani position which is being appreciated. Nobody knows what the people of Kashmir are saying. So this is really unfortunate that here we are talking in the United Nations where the will of the people is supreme. But unfortunately, in our part of the world, the people's will is being trampled upon by the under the boots of the Indian paramilitary forces. I mean, you have more than 600,000 troops, and it's official that you have more than 600,000 troops. I mean, five times what you have in Afghanistan, the NATO forces, anywhere else in the world, in Kashmir. And still, the world community continues to remain silent about Kashmir. So we feel that, yes, India-Pakistan dialogue is important. We support India-Pakistan dialogue because that's the only way through which Kashmir can resolve. But this dialogue cannot be fruitful unless and until you associate the people of Kashmir with this dialogue, the leadership of Kashmir. I mean, what is lacking is the fact that Kashmiris are never a part of this dialogue process.
I have to ask about the Indian interlocutors who've been basically speaking and talking to Kashmiri leaders and various groups.
Well, I think, you know, I think the Indian government is fully seized of the issue. I mean, the very fact that interlocutors for the past 1 year, more than 1 year, have been roaming about in Kashmir and trying to meet people. The fact is that Kashmiris have spoken very plainly. We want a solution in accordance with the wishes of the people. We don't want a solution which is under the Indian constitution or under the Pakistani constitution. We want a solution which is in agreement with international agreements which have been made to the people of Kashmir. The right to self-determination for us is non-negotiable. While India is looking for a solution which is a solution which is to its own liking, which is not acceptable to the people of Kashmir. So we feel that if the interlocutors have to come up with a report on Kashmir, that report has to inculcate the genuine aspirations of the people of Kashmir, and that is for the right of self-determination, that is for Azadi, what we call freedom. And those aspirations cannot be ignored.
What is your position regarding those groups who still have guns?
See, I think if you look at it, you'll appreciate the fact that, yes, militancy has been a part of the Kashmir struggle. But since the last 3 years, Kashmiris have spoken through the language of peace. I mean, since 2008, hundreds and thousands of people have come out the streets of Kashmir. Not a single bullet has been fired by any Kashmiri militant or mujahid. These groups also want to give peace a genuine chance. I mean, you know, we believe that militancy was thrust upon the people of Kashmir. We don't want to hold the gun. We don't want to be violent. But violence is being thrust upon us. The fact that last year 120 students were killed by India, and all of them were non-combatants. All of them were students, mainly, you know, protesting peacefully on the streets. So today the Kashmir struggle has completely transformed. It's a completely indigenous struggle. It's completely a people's struggle, a peaceful struggle. And we hope the response from India would also be peaceful. Because right now what we are seeing is that, on the one hand, we are talking about, you know, violence in Jammu and Kashmir. But it has to be understood that the violence is being perpetuated by none less than the state of India. There is no violence right now coming from Kashmiris. So it is good that the militants are also giving peace a chance. And we hope that the world community will support this endeavor and impress upon India to come forward and resolve the Kashmir issue with dialogue with Pakistan and the people of Kashmir.
As the leader of All Parties Hurriyat Conference, what is your stand on the issue of referendum?
Well, we believe that ultimately the issue has to be put to the people. I mean, that is why I was referring to the fact that the world community cannot have double standards when they support the will of the people in Libya, when they talk about the will of the people in Tunisia, in Syria, in Bahrain. They can't ignore the voices of reason from Kashmir. If you support the will of the people in other parts of the world, you can't ignore the will of the people in Kashmir. So we believe that UN resolutions, the right of self-determination, is the right of the people of Kashmir and the world body body cannot backtrack on its commitments which they have made to the people of Kashmir.
That's Kashmiri leader Mirwaiz Omar Farooq speaking with FSRN's Salim Rizvi at the UN in New York. In related news, Indian officials deported alternative radio host David Barsamian from New Delhi over the weekend, allegedly on visa violations. Barsamian, who speaks fluent Hindi and Urdu and covered the Kashmir separatist movement, intended to gather interviews about recently acknowledged unmarked graves in the Indian-occupied region. As FSRN reported earlier this month, police in Kashmir have been cracking down on local and foreign journalists, in some cases physically attacking them. In New York City this weekend, dozens of people were mass arrested protesting the country's financial system as part of the week-long Occupy Wall Street protests. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Noor arrived on the scene minutes after the arrests had been made. He brings us the story.
It was a chaotic scene in Lower Manhattan Saturday as police arrested about 80 protesters taking part in a rally in March. The demonstration was part of the protest encampment in New York's financial district, known as Occupy Wall Street, that started on September 17th. Protesters say they represent the majority of Americans whose interests are not being served by the country's economic and political system. The New York Police Department's handling of the arrests has come under fire as a number of videos emerge showing officers using heavy-handed tactics. Police use large orange nets to trap protesters who were then pepper sprayed.
Into the garage! Is that where you want us to go?
Among them was 25-year-old Chelsea Elliott, who described the incident minutes after it happened.
And then I turn around and I hear, or like see this girl having her face slammed on the sidewalk, blood. And I scream, why are they doing this? And then I look at the cop, and then I look back, and there's a cop with mace, and he just squirts, like, boom, like all of us in the face, including, like, got some of it got on the cop that I was talking to, and I just fell to the ground and started sobbing.
Protesters captured some of the attacks on video, including the arrest of 21-year-old Bronx resident Hero Vincent.
He's just a kid, officer.
He's a kid.
Vincent, who was released Sunday, said police attacked him when he tried to calm the crowd and organize people to leave.
That's when the police just charged at me with his fist and just started, you know, swinging at me. And another policeman pushed me, and I'm backing up. And as I'm backing up, I hit the barricade. And then they come at, I look at them, they come at me. I go over, and then four policemen just start, you know, beating on me. Yelling at me, stop resisting arrest while I'm just laying there, I'm not fighting back. They kicked me in my stomach, knocked the breath out of me, hit me with their baton. They put their knees into my face, not in my head, into my face, into the ground, and just laughing.
While other protesters were charged with blocking traffic and resisting arrest, Vincent faces the more serious charge of assaulting a police officer. But he says he's confident that the numerous videos of the incident will exonerate him, and he's determined to continue the fight against this country's economic policies.
If there's anything called the epitome of a struggle, me and my family lived it. We were foreclosed on. My father had trouble finding a job, still hasn't found one. I had trouble finding a job, still haven't found one. My sister's in college, her tuition's doubling. They're trying to fight for her financial aid. We struggle with food. I've even slept on the bench a few nights before this occasion, you know.
Despite the latest round of arrests, the protest encampment now enters its 10th day at the privately owned Zuccotti Park, which the protesters are calling Liberty Plaza. Demonstrators use the space for nightly meetings of the popular committee known as the General Assembly. After a week of deliberations, participants have now agreed on a number of basic demands, including an end to policies that result in the concentration of wealth and unlimited influence of money in politics, and the creation of a participatory economic and political system that opposes discrimination and racism and promotes environmental justice. 23-year-old community organizer Michael Strom says he hopes these demands can be a catalyst for a movement that can challenge corporate domination.
So we put together these demands to be accessible and encompass all of these different forms of suffering and really bring people together so that we can begin to articulate exactly what strategies and processes we will use to struggle for these demands.
Protesters vow to continue the Occupy Wall Street demonstration until these demands are met. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
The U.S. Postal Service is facing a massive multi-billion dollar deficit and deep cuts to its workforce. In an attempt to find a solution, it's become clear that although the Postal Service operates independently of the federal government, it's not independent of politics. Dueling bills introduced by each party that aim to reform the agency's finances are facing opposition and prompting a national day of action by postal workers. Michael Lawson has more.
An online search for Postal Service reform brings up discussions from 1980 over how to change the agency's operations. This year, the discussion has been revived again as the Postal Service faces a $10 billion deficit. Postmaster General Thomas Donahoe held a news conference earlier this month to announce a plan to save $20 billion by 2015.
We want the Postal Service to be profitable, to compete for customers, and to drive economic growth. And to do so, we must create a low-cost, streamlined operational network.
First-class mail, as well as traditional stamp-bearing mail, has declined by nearly 50% over the past decade, according to the U.S. Postal Service. Since 2006, the Postal Service has reduced costs by $12 billion. Donahoe's proposals, including consolidation or closure of processing facilities and changing the standard for timely mail delivery, are designed to save the Postal Service up to $3 billion a year. But chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Daryl Issa, wants more done. Issa's bill would eliminate Saturday delivery and sell advertising space at post offices and on mail trucks. A financial control board would be created to oversee the agency's finances, including allowing 120,000 layoffs currently prohibited by collective bargaining agreements. Employees would also have to pay more for retirement and health care benefits. Sally Davidow of the American Postal Workers Union says the bill represents a push toward privatization.
The ISA bill calls for $2 billion worth of cuts in mail processing facilities and $1 billion worth of cuts in post offices and a reduction in service and the right to lay off. And really what they're talking about doing is just destroying, you know, this great public institution.
Four postal worker unions, as well as members of the community, will be holding rallies in every congressional district on Tuesday in support of H.R. 1351, introduced by Democrat Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts and signed onto by 215 co-sponsors. The bill would return $7 billion in retirement funds to the Postal Service and granted greater flexibility to use the funds for early buyouts. The bill would also restructure a current agreement enacted in 2006 that requires the Postal Service to prepay its retiree health care benefits over a 10-year period based on a 75-year window in the future. David Dow and others say this requirement, at a cost of $20 billion since 2006, is the real cause for the agency's financial woes.
It's sort of an accounting gimmick, really. It makes the federal deficit look lower by forcing the Postal Service to make these payments because they're made from the Postal Service, which is not part of the federal government, the federal budget, into accounts that are part of the federal budget.
While the Postal Service has said it agrees with some provisions in the ISA bill, it says it would have posted a $600 million profit over the past 4 years if not for the $5 billion in upfront pension payments. Josh Sewell with Taxpayers for Common Sense says Congress is what has kept the Postal Service from making itself profitable.
Frankly, what the Postal Service needs is for the federal government to decide whether or not it's going to be a federal agency or if it's going to truly be a private business, because right now it's this quasi-entity that is required to be profitable, but then Congress continually meddles in preventing it from running like a private business.
President Obama's deficit reduction plan addresses Postal Service finances with ideas from H.R. 1351 and an end to Saturday delivery. Republican John McCain introduced companion legislation to ISA's bill in the Senate on Friday. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
That's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.